This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm Kathleen Harris. And on this week's edition of Lifetime Income, we'll be talking about something I think a lot of us probably need to be thinking more about than we are, which is, where are we going to be as we get older? Are we going to be able to stay in our homes? Are we thinking about moving to a senior community? Are we thinking about moving to an assisted living advanced care facility? What is the plan for ourselves? So today on the program, we're going to talk with LaDawn Montagy. She's actually a member of the Global Social Enterprise Initiative at Georgetown University. And this organization in Phillips, the corporate group Phillips, has been working together to figure out how technology and architecture can help people successfully stay at home as they get older. So that's coming up later on today's program.
And I know tax season's over. You're probably thinking of vacation. You don't want to even think about your 1099s and all the stuff you had to do to get your taxes. But, you know, so many of the things we talk about here on the program are about retirement planning. How do you get there? Coming up with a roadmap. Well, it's obvious. You got to put money aside to fund for that retirement. Now, most of you are probably doing that through, let's say, pension plans you have in your business, 401k plans at work, if you're a teacher, 403b plans, or even 457s. But I want to talk about personal savings outside that pension area, because on the personal side, the difference needs to be done tax efficiently, because if it isn't, there's a big outcome in terms of how much you're going to have when you retire. And you need to keep a balance between what you have on the personal side and what you have on the pension side. Because what you don't want to do is you don't want to get to retirement where every source of income you get is taxable. Your pension from the company or from the government, your Social Security because of your income is taxable, or distributions from your IRA or 401k program. So we're going to be talking about tax planning when it comes to investments and the difference it can make towards contributing and building wealth for your retirement.
Now, I think no one out there likes to reach April 15th and get a call from their accountant saying, you know what, I got some bad news for you. You got a whopping tax bill this year from the IRS. No one wants to hear that. So I think there's a balance, Jim, when you're thinking about investing in your taxable accounts in terms of doing a little bit of tax planning, because it can make a huge difference over time in the overall savings that you're able to build up with your wealth. You know, it's a pretty simple concept, Jim. Bottom line, the less you pay in taxes, the more you have to invest. So, Jim, why don't we start with some tax planning basics for our listeners here today?
Well, you know, the most important number that you need when you're talking about savings or investment, because we've done shows before, what's your number? In other words, what's the amount that you're going to need when you retire? Well, there's another number that you need to know besides what that number is when you retire, and that is, what is your marginal tax bracket? That is what your investments are going to be taxed at. Now, there's exception, you know, total income. Obviously, the amount of income that you have is going to determine what rate your investments are taxed at. For example, at a certain level, you move up from the Bush tax rates to the Obama tax rates. And the different kinds of investments that you have are taxed at different brackets.
Jim, I think this whole idea of tax brackets can get a little bit confusing. It doesn't really help that the American Taxpayer Relief Act of 2012 kind of layered a whole lot of different tax brackets, along with the additional tax that was charged to everybody as a result of the Affordable Care Act. And so what you've got is kind of a mishmash of marginal tax brackets plus add-ons for the Affordable Care Act. And it can get a little overwhelming. So, Jim, why don't you just walk everyone through the basics of understanding your tax bracket and how all these different types of taxation sort of affect each other in terms of your net investment income on your taxable accounts?
Okay, well, there's multiple levels of taxation, but let's talk about the one that you probably are familiar with as a taxpayer. That's your tax bracket. If you are single, your tax rate can go from 10 to 35% if you earn under $406,750. If you're single and you basically go over that $406,000, you go from the 35% bracket to the 39.6. Likewise, if you're married, you're in the 10 to 35% bracket up to $457,600, and you immediately jump up to 39.6%. Now, there's another category for how dividends and capital gains are taxed. If you're single, you make over $200,000, your dividends and capital gains go from a 15% tax bracket to a 20% tax bracket. If you're married, at $250,000, you jump from the 15 to 20%. Now, it doesn't stop there, because also that $200,000 level for a single individual, the $250,000 for a married couple, also applies to the Obamacare tax. There's an additional 3.8% tax on dividends, capital gains, and investment income once you exceed $200,000 as a single individual, $250,000 as a married couple. And also, here's something you also need to understand. Interest income is taxed at the highest tax rate of 43.6%. And there's one other tax, and we're not going to make this too complicated. Once you reach a certain level, $250,000, $300,000, you also start losing your itemized deductions. 3% of your gross income is subtracted from your itemized deductions. That adds another 1.2%. So you can see it starts to add up the higher your income goes, which means it's more important when you're investing personally, you're doing so tax efficiently.
Jim, I think you're bringing up a really great point here, which is that if you're in a lower tax bracket, you've got a lot more options in terms of things you can think about investing in terms of what your short-term capital gains rate is going to be versus your long-term capital gains rate versus your interest income rate, whatever it is. When you're lower tax bracket, you can pretty much invest in almost anything that you want to and not worry so much about the tax consequences, because net-net, they're not going to affect you ridiculously over your marginal tax bracket with the total tax you'll be paying on those investment income. However, once you start reaching those higher tax brackets, Jim, you have to start thinking about being a little bit more careful with how you're positioning your investments in terms of their tax efficiency. And the reason is that you're paying your federal income tax rates of anywhere from 15% to 43.4%, again, depending on the type of investment income that you're making. And then let's just say you add on top of that your state tax bracket. And if you're here in California, maybe that's another 13% you're adding on to that there. So in some states, between your federal and your state taxes, you could be paying a whopping almost 60% of your income and your investment income in taxes if you're not planning for your investment tax efficiency properly. So really what you want to think about doing is, especially as you start hitting those higher tax brackets, is start doing a little bit of tax efficiency planning with your investments, because over time, it's going to dramatically impact the amount of wealth you've had set aside to retire with. So thinking about this whole concept, Jim, about being smart with how to invest your taxable assets, you know, this is why the rich often pay a much lower tax rate than we think that they should be paying. And the reason they do so is because they're really, really smart about the types of investments they pursue. And those investments they pursue have a lower tax consequence than other types of investments could. You and I were thinking about this, and you did some calculations. And by being tax smart with how you're investing your money, you can actually double the amount of money you have set aside by the time you retire if you're being smart with your tax planning.
And, you know, one of the things I wanted to illustrate, now we're going to go through some numbers, but I think you're going to get the gist of what I'm trying to get across here. Now, I wanted to make some assumptions, and let's assume that you're saving, I'm going to use even numbers, so let's assume that you are saving personally $10,000 annually. And let's assume a long-term stock market return to 10%. Now, forget the fact that we've had some bear markets in the last 10 years. It wasn't 10%. But for illustration purposes, it's going to get the point across. Now, what I did is I took a look at tax brackets. I think there's like 8 or 9 states that are tax-free. So I wanted to take a look at federal tax rates, which are 10, 15%, add a little state. So I looked at a 20% bracket, combined bracket, federal, state, 40% bracket, federal and state, and a 60%, which you could be if you're in a high six-figure or seven-figure income. Now, follow me when I talk about this. If you have $10,000, let's say you're earning $10,000 a year, and you are in a 20% bracket, that means after taxes, you have $8,000 to invest. Now, if you're investing that $8,000 over 10 years, in other words, you're investing $8,000 each year after taxes, it grows to $159,000. $454,000 in 20 years, and $1.3 million in 30 years. Let's move forward if you're in a 40% bracket. Obviously, if you earn $10,000 of investment income, you only have $6,000 after paying all of your taxes. So you only have $6,000 a year that you can compound. Over 10 years at 10%, $6,000 invested each year grows to $96,000, 20 years, $344,000, and roughly about $987,000 in 30 years. Now let's go to that high tax bracket. If you're earning $10,000 of investment income, you could pay up to 60% and only have $4,000 left after paying your taxes. Well, if you're investing $4,000 over a 10-year period, it only grows to $64,000 in 10 years, $229,000 in 20 years. In 30 years, it's $658,000. Here's the point. In 20 years, you will have twice as much wealth at retirement if you can keep your investments in that 20% tax bracket. And there's a way you can do that, which we're going to talk about shortly. So think of it this way. You're earning income on your investments, dividends, capital gains, whatever it is, interest income, rents, how you derive your investment income. Think of it this way. The more that you keep and the more of that income that is taxed at a lower bracket, that simply means you have more money that you can compound over time. And if you want to understand Warren Buffett, yes, everybody knows that he's known for his stock picking prowess. But I'll tell you something else he's often less known for. He's a genius when it comes to tax minimization. Berkshire Hathaway is Warren Buffett's personal tax shelter, where he pays taxes a little over 15% a year. So one of the reasons he's one of the richest men in the world is not only has he been a good stock picker, he invests for stocks in the long run, he picks good companies, but Warren Buffett keeps most of what he earns from his investments and pays the least amount of taxes as possible.
And Jim, I think, like you mentioned, a lot of us think of Buffett as a really shrewd stock picker. We sort of pay attention to the stocks he's buying and selling and why he's buying and selling those stocks. But as you mentioned, he's also a smart tax planner. He's a smart businessman. He minimizes his taxes so that he only pays taxes of about 20% on most of his investment income. And hedge fund managers, similar situation. The smart money is the money that seeks a tax advantage situations. And one of the ways they do this is through having a smart corporate structure or their own businesses. You know, there's ways to shelter your taxable income through using a smart corporate structure. And we talked last week about selling your own personal business. There's ways to structure that buyout process that make the buyout to you a lot less taxable to you. So you actually get to keep more of that buyout money. So Jim, why don't we talk a little bit about ways in which you can structure a personal corporation to really maximize the tax benefit of having a corporation.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of ways you can do it. You can set up a corporation as a C corporation, and let's say you have a sizable business and a public company buys you. Well, they're simply exchanging their stock for your stock. There is no taxable event until you sell the new stock that you get. You can also do things like charitable remainder trust, which is another way you can shelter taxes on a business that you own and sometimes free and clear property. And also, here's one that you never thought of. If you have a C corporation and you invest in dividend paying stocks, now there's a rule here. That means dividends of stocks that are subject to double taxation, taxed once at the corporate level, taxed once at the individual level. If you have a C corporation, you can exclude 70% of your dividends from taxation. Also, if you own 20% or more of a company, as Buffett often does, you can exclude up to 80% of the dividends. No wonder Warren Buffett loves investing in stocks. Not only are they taxed at a lower rate, but because Berkshire Hathaway is a C corporation, well, Warren often doesn't pay taxes on 70 to 80% of the income he receives on those dividends. Now you know why he's one of the richest men in the world.
Well, Jim, I think some of our investors out there may not be able to have their own C corporation, but I'm just thinking about a lot of the questions I get about taxes and investing. And I think a lot of people I talk to, unfortunately, don't really understand the long-term implications of taxation on the investment strategy that they're choosing. Example, they don't really realize that there's a difference between the taxation on dividends and interest, and that difference can range, you know, again, you can pay the difference between 15% to 43.4% on different kinds of interest versus dividends, which are 15% to 20%. The same thing with short-term capital gains. You can pay from between 15 to 43.4% on short-term capital gains. So if you're thinking about maximizing the taxation on your taxable investments, what you really need to do is make sure that you structure them properly, because it can make a significant difference in the amount of wealth you're able to accumulate over the long term. So, Jim, why don't we talk about some different ways to minimize taxation on various different types of taxable investments?
You know, when you're trying to invest personally and minimize the taxes, you have four methodologies that you can use, or strategies to reduce your taxes. The first one that comes to mind is tax-free investing. You invest in tax-free bonds, and especially if you're in a state that has high income taxes, if you buy the tax-free bonds of that state, you don't pay any federal taxes, you don't pay any state taxes. Another method is tax-sheltered. Now, you can do that through MLPs, through pipeline companies, through certain real estate investment trusts that you can invest in the market, where a lot of the distributions that come to you, royalty trust is another one that comes to mind, where part of the income or a majority of the income is sheltered from taxation. And many of these investments, from REITs to MLPs, pipelines, and royalty trusts, they pay dividends of 6 to 8%. Imagine getting 6 to 8% and not paying taxes, 60, 70, 80% of it. So tax sheltered is one form. Tax deferral, you know, that's what you're doing when you invest in a 401k program or a pension plan. And also when you invest in a tax deferred annuity, what you're doing is you're allowing your investments to compound. So any gains, any interest are tax deferred, and you don't have to pay that. It means that you have more money at work for you. And then finally, tax minimized investments such as dividends or real estate that have a certain shelter to them, where part of the income is sheltered from federal taxes or taxed at a lower rate. For example, 43.4% highest taxable rate on interest versus 15 to 20% on dividends and capital gains. So you can see how important knowing your tax bracket really is. It's the one number, besides that number you want to find out what it's going to require to get you to retirement. You also want to know what your marginal tax bracket is before you invest, because that's really going to determine the various strategies that you're going to use. And then once you get into that higher tax bracket, maybe you're high six figures or you're making seven figures, then you're going to probably end up using multiple strategies rather than one, because you don't want to be reliant on just one approach.
And Jim, I'm also thinking that one of the other reasons to think about having some kind of a taxable investment portfolio is that when you reach retirement, you want to have some portion of your income situation over which you have more control. You know, once you retire, you start pulling down your pension income and your Social Security. You start getting your required minimum distributions from your IRA, which again, the percentage of that you have to withdraw goes up every single year. You sort of get in a situation where you're forced to take a certain amount of income. Again, this is a quality problem to have a lot of income coming in retirement, but you get yourself in a situation where you're sort of taking all this mandatory income you've got to take. And if you don't have a personal investment portfolio on the side, there's really no way that you can offset any of that income with a personal investment portfolio. So it's a good strategy to have, especially if you're someone who's going to be taking in and drawing down a lot of income in retirement, is to think about having, again, a taxable personal investment portfolio on the side. We've got a lot of clients in this situation. They use their personal portfolio to offset their taxable income, and it helps them sort of to be able to better control their tax situation and minimize the impact of their overall taxes.
So as we talk about this, I mean, there's other things you can do. We haven't got into things that you can do if you set up a corporation, various business structures, various pension plans. But what I wanted to hit upon is investment taxation, because you don't want everything tied up in a pension plan, as Kathleen just mentioned, because then you're going to be caught into a perpetual tax trap when you retire, where every single source of income you get is taxed. And think of how they changed the tax laws. The various things they've done with getting rid of itemized deductions, phasing those out, adding additional taxes if your income gets to a certain level, taxation of your Social Security. Do you really want to find yourself in retirement where everything you have, you're trapped? It's almost like being an employee of a corporation where, you know, you report all your income and all you have is your itemized deductions. And then based on what your income is, you may even be losing some of your itemized deductions or get caught with alternative minimum tax. So how you structure your investment portfolio to minimize taxes, plain and simple, there's a couple things I want you to walk away from on today's show. I want you to find out, either call your tax advisor, your CPA, what is your marginal tax bracket? That's the next dollar that you earn. If you earn one more dollar this year, that's the tax rate you're going to pay on that additional dollar. You need to know that. And depending on your tax bracket, that allows you to adjust your investment strategy. And if you own a business, I've got good news for you. Depending on how you set it up, you have a plethora of tax strategies you can use, whether you're operating your company and building it up, or when it comes to selling your company. And you can use these tax strategies to pay zero taxes when you sell your company. And let me remind you, I think it was Chief Justice Marshall that once said, you are under no obligation to pay more taxes than are required. So use tax advantages of the law. They were created for various reasons, to create incentives for investing, for certain sectors, because the government wants you to invest. They want you to save for retirement because they want you to be less dependent on the government. So it behooves you to do some tax planning and do it now. You still have 6 months left of the year to take advantage and minimize those taxes. You don't want to wait next year or the end of the year and panic. All of a sudden, you're getting capital gain distributions from your mutual funds. You got a bonus at the end of the year. Who knows what happens? And all of a sudden, come April 15th, you owe a lot of money.
And Jim, before we sort of wrap up this segment of the program, I just want to mention something we've seen clients do, which is that obviously the market has been very choppy over the past 6 years or so. And I think we've seen a lot of investors get really sort of psyched out by the market and make decisions to pull the trigger and sell their entire portfolio because they're scared of a market correction. And we just talked about how if you're in the highest marginal tax bracket, you're earning a really high level of income. If you'll pull the trigger on your portfolio and you sell everything in your portfolio, and let's just say everything in there has been held for less than a year, you're paying short-term capital gains rate on everything that you've just sold in your portfolio. That's a 43.4% tax. Now, you just thought maybe the market was going to correct, but you for sure just locked in for yourself a 43.4% reduction in your taxable profits from your portfolio just by making that decision to pull the trigger and sell on the short term. So again, you maybe thought there was going to be a correction, but by pulling the trigger, you basically guaranteed yourself a 43.4% correction on your overall investment income.
You know, Kathleen, I think maybe what we ought to do is transition to a case study of a high-income investor in some of the tax strategies that we use to solve this particular problem and things that we're going to be implementing in the future that are going to minimize those taxes immensely.
Well, Jim, I think I've mentioned to you, I've been talking to a lot of doctors recently, and whoo, those doctors are making some pretty nice money out there. And they sort of end up with these quality problems of having too much income and not enough ways to reduce their taxes on it. So let's talk about Paul Sherman, Dr. Sherman. He's a surgeon out there in Boca Raton, Florida, a very fine surgeon. He's currently employed by a hospital group, so he's a W-2 employee. He's making over $1 million a year as a surgeon. I really feel pity for this poor individual bringing down $1 million salary. But he's got a problem, and again, it's a quality problem. Right now, he's paying 43.4% taxes on his income. Now, he's in Florida. He's not paying any state income tax, but just from the federal level, he's paying 43.4% taxes on his income, and it really pains him every spring to write that massive, massive check to the IRS. It just makes him feel upset. So he and I were talking about how does he reduce his taxable income, number one, and what are some things he should do with his investment portfolio on the taxable side that's going to be a tax-smart way of investing so he's not giving away 43.4% of his investment income as well?
Well, here's the thing. He had roughly about $1.5 million in taxable accounts. Currently, a bulk of it is invested, like many investors, for the highest return. In this case, it was junk bond funds. Now, that's okay with the interest rates coming down instead of going up. It did not work as well last year. But he wanted to get a higher rate of return. And when interest rates come down, the value of junk bonds go up. He wanted to get that 10% return. And one of the reasons is, well, he's facing high taxation. The problem, all of that income was taxed at his highest marginal tax bracket of 43.6%. So we wanted to take a look at what would you have to do, and this is one of the things I try to illustrate, to earn 10% after taxes. If you went into a bond fund, given his 43.6% tax, he would need to earn roughly 17.7% pre-tax. If he went with short-term capital gains, like some of these high-flying stock mutual funds where there's a lot of trading in the account, all the gains are short-term, same problem, 17.7%. Dividends, on the other hand, which are taxed at 20% plus the Obamacare tax because of his income level of 3.8, he would only need to earn 13.1% on dividends in stocks to get that 10% return. Same thing with long-term capital gains, 13%. Obviously, on tax-free bonds, to earn 10%, he would obviously need some capital appreciation in addition to the interest income, because you just can't find 10%. I can remember when I started in this business back in the 80s, believe it or not, folks, we were getting 10% on tax-free bonds. A lot of people say those are the good old days. But also, there were other things that he was doing. He was maxing out his 401k, IRA. He had tax-exempt municipal bonds, which we suggested, look, let's move a lot of this into some tax-frees at the federal level because, you know, you get 6% in a junk bond fund. Actually, it's probably closer to 5.5% today. And 5%, you know, after taxes, he's probably not making very much. The other thing is MLPs in pipeline companies that have distributions of 6%, 7%, and 8%, where maybe 70 to 80% of the income is sheltered from taxation. And the other thing is the idea of owning some blue chip stocks that are not only taxed because of dividends at the lower tax bracket of 20% versus his 43% tax bracket, but also if he held them longer term, they would also be taxed at the lower tax bracket versus the shorter term gains, which are taxed at that high 43% bracket. So what we did was change the tax strategy, moving from taxable bonds to tax-free bonds, dividends, and also MLPs and some pipeline companies that had the same distribution or almost the same yield as the junk bond funds, in many cases higher, but a good bulk of the dividends were exempt from taxes or sheltered.
I think we also encourage him to avoid short-term capital gains, you know, investing in those high-growth, high-turnover type funds. Again, it just really can kill you on the capital gains in terms of taxation as far as that's concerned. You know, Jim, you've talked a little bit about how we helped him really be smarter about how he's investing his taxable portfolio. He and I also had a series of conversations about reducing his taxable income. You know, we mentioned that he's actually right now a W-2 wage earner employee of a hospital group. And so he and I started having a series of conversations about, is it worth his while, is it worth his time to form his own corporation, renegotiate his contract with the hospital, maybe become a 1099 employee, and run everything through a corporation? Because right now, he's able to max out his 401k, $17,500. I mean, that's nice to have that be taken away from your taxable income, but that's not a huge chunk of change out of $1 million paycheck. You know, he's maxing out his IRA. He's putting away $5,500 a year right now. Again, not providing him with any upfront tax benefit, but there's long-term tax deferred growth on that. So again, he and I were talking about how can he really start making a big chunk of his money start to be, you know, exempt or deferred from taxes. And so we talked about this whole idea of forming his corporation. If he has his own corporate structure and it's structured wisely, he can actually start to set up his own retirement plans. set up his own 401k, and he, as the employer, can put away $52,000 for his 401k account. And on the employee side, he can put away $17,500 on the savings side. If he does a profit sharing plan as well, he can put away another $52,000. If he does a defined benefit plan, he can put away up to $210,000. So net net, if he sets up his own corporation, there's the possibility that by running all this money through his corporation, he could potentially be putting away around $300,000 tax deferred into these retirement plans instead of paying 43.4% tax to the government on those money. So again, there's some benefits to sort of rethinking your employment situation if you're a really, really high wage earner. Might be some benefits toward, you know, going it on your own.
Don't forget the benefits of taxation on investments in a C Corp. If you have your own C Corp, and let's say you invest in the stock of an Exxon, as Warren Buffett did, well, in his case, well, he only owns 3% of Exxon. That's still a lot, 40 million shares. But in his case, he's not going to pay taxes on 70% of the dividends that he gets. So, you know, there's other advantages, too, to the C Corporation that you can use to your own advantage of building up some assets in that corporation. And then, if you get bought out by a public corporation, you can exchange your C corporate stock for the corporate stock of the company that buys you, and there is no tax on the sale of your company. The only tax you would pay is long-term capital gains when eventually if you wanted to sell some of the stock. So there's all kinds of advantages here that you can use. The important point that we're trying to stress here, there's so many things that you can do to accumulate a lot more wealth. And once again, folks, remember, you need to know your marginal tax bracket. Number two, don't feel guilty about reducing your taxes. Everybody in Congress does it, and even the wealthy do it. You are not required to pay more taxes than legally you're required. And remember the difference of compounding money over time. $1 less you pay in taxes is one more dollar you have in your pocket to build your net worth and compound over a period of time. It starts to become considerable.
Jim, as we've been talking today, I've realized we keep using that P word again, that horrible P word, the plan word, that we keep talking about having taxation approach plan for your portfolio. We always talk about having a retirement income plan. We talk about having a financial plan. You know, one of the plans that we've talked about off and on over the past year or so, Jim, is having a plan for where you're going to live in retirement. We've talked about changing states. Today, we're going to talk about thinking through some of the items you'll need to be planning for as you think about where you're going to live when you age, what type of living situation you're going to be in. And helping us with some of those things to think about is our guest today, LaDawn Montague. Again, she's coming to us from the Global Social Enterprise Initiative at Georgetown University. She's got some great comments on things to think about in terms of technology and architecture when you're thinking about where you're going to live as you get a little bit older. Welcome to the second segment of today's Lifetime Income Program. Now, as many of you know, we've talked over the past year or so with a number of experts about different ways to talk to your loved ones about the process of aging. Where are you going to live? Who are you going to live next to? How are needs going to be met? We've talked with people who have walked us through every step of aging with our parents and our kids. Today, we're going to be talking with LaDawn Montague. She leads the Global Social Enterprise Initiative at Georgetown University. They have been doing some really exciting work with Philips about how to wed technology with living space to help seniors better age in place. So coming up, LaDawn Montague and I have a conversation about how technology helps us be able to stay at home as we age. What I thought I'd do first, LaDawn, is just sort of talk about the reason why we thought it might be of interest to our listeners to have you on our program today. We sort of focus on this program on helping our listeners understand finances and retirement, and sometimes what are sort of the decisions that they make in retirement or approaching retirement that affect their finances throughout retirement, what type of pension options they select, when to take their Social Security, and what I think is pertinent to our conversation today, which is the cost of where they're going to live in retirement. And I thought what we'd do is talk a little bit about this, your aging well working session about seniors and aging, and what sort of was the outcome of that particular group of minds that came together to talk about our aging communities and how they perceive their living space.
Sure, sounds great.
So when we talk about where to live in retirement, what we've mostly focused on in our program is state locations and how changing states in retirement can change your cost of living and your tax bracket and that, et cetera. But this study seemed to focus more on what type of home or community people might choose to live in retirement. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of the issues or considerations that came out of this working group about communities and aging.
Sure. I think top line, the most important outcome is that as we surveyed the consumers who participated in this, who were predominantly baby boomers, what we learned is that really 91% said that they want to stay in their home or their community when they're older. They don't want to go into a nursing home. They don't want to live with their kids. And, you know, that is something that is really, really an important takeaway. So that means it doesn't matter if it's an urban setting, a rural setting, whatever setting, home is home, and that's important to them.
And I was also wondering, too, you surveyed that 91% said they wanted to stay in their homes as they aged, which I think is a huge statistic. That's not 50%, that's not 75%, that's close to 100% of people say that they want to stay in their homes as they age. What were some of the challenges that you sort of came across as you were talking with these individuals about actually the logistics of aging in their homes if they didn't want to move?
Well, one of the most important findings of this is that while they want to stay in their homes and communities, they're not necessarily taking the necessary measures to upgrade their homes, do renovations, or invest in technology. And a lot of that actually has to do with perceived cost or their view that upgrades or technology is even necessary, something that they want. Now, there's what they're saying, but then, you know, some of what we're reading into this is, okay, do they really also just not know where to start? And some of them said that, frankly. That was one of the questions we asked them. And what are the things that they really need to consider in making choices, decisions about how to prepare the physical space in their home? But the other part is just asking the question of when you are old, when you may have to become dependent, what steps do you need to take to stay independent? That's not a mindset that anybody really wants to put themselves in. So rejecting this notion of they need to even take the steps to prepare their homes, to prepare their physical environment, and be independent the way we all proclaim we want to be. Nobody wants to really do that and think of things that way. And unfortunately, what happens is we find ourselves in that uh-oh moment when we're in it, or our children find themselves in that uh-oh moment as, you know, parents fight off their children saying, you know, come live with me, or let's figure out a safer place for you. But we have to educate people on how technology, how upgrades can benefit the physical environment, what are the things you have access to your community, and what that really means in real terms. And it doesn't mean that it has to be some sort of clunky handbar or some sort of medicinal-looking or frail-looking piece of technology that sticks on your heart but says, I'm ill. That's not necessarily what we're talking about, but I think the perception is those are the things that are required as we get older.
I'm wondering, you know, we have a lot of listeners to our program here who are dealing with aging parents, and it sounds like part of this has to do with reframing, retooling the conversation about aging at home in a way that makes it more, I guess, palatable is the term I'm looking for those that are actually going to be aging in their homes. I'm wondering if your series of conversations with not only these baby boomers you surveyed, but also the people in the industries trying to serve this particular community, if there's any sort of talking points or ways to frame this discussion with parents or people that you love that are aging that might help this conversation about needed changes in the home environment to sort of get rolling along.
Sure. You know, I think the first thing is, you know, my mother is 85 and she lives by herself and she lives in an independent living 55 plus community. And she uses a locker as well. But what we have tried to do is find out first and foremost, what is it that she wants? It's really important to start from that position. Otherwise, they will reject everything if we try and impose on them what we want and what will make us as children comfortable or us as caregivers or others. It has to start from the point of what the individual who is older wants for themselves to be independent and to have control and be empowered. And then from there, help them do that. Now, what we as children or supporters of these people in the community or family or otherwise, what we need is peace of mind as well. We need to know that we are not shunning our loved ones or the people that we care about. So finding that balance. To your point about reframing this, yes, absolutely. So it's not about aging. I think it has to be about, okay, what do you want? And how do I help you have your control, your own decision making, and control to do what it is that you want to do? If you don't want me to come pick you up and take you shopping, you know, when I can't do it necessarily, you call me and you don't necessarily even want to call me because you may feel guilty about calling me and taking me away from something else, then let's figure out how do we use your cell phone to connect to a resource that is a transportation resource that's available in the community and contact them. And maybe that's tied to some sort of prepaid account so you don't have to worry about fumbling with money to pay them. And you just make the appointment. They come, pick you up, take you where you want to go, and then they come back and pick you up and bring you back home. You know, there are lots of technologies that are universal use technologies. They're not necessarily targeted to people who are aging, and they benefit everybody. You know, iPads, everybody's using iPads or tablets these days. And so at the touch of our fingertips, there's so many types of resources that people want to use. One of the things that we found both from this survey, the one that we did in September with Philips, is that baby boomers are using the internet for financial purposes, for online banking, purchases, otherwise, and also for ordering prescriptions, medications, making doctor's appointments. So they're online, and these are all elements that help everybody be independent. These types of uses of technology are not limited to people who are older. They're not about aging. They're about independence. They're about self-empowerment. They're about us being able to make our own decisions and take our own action. Even in our survey, what we found out with the younger baby boomers is that more than anything else, too, they're using technology for pure entertainment purposes. And that's another mechanism for independence and self-control.
So you're talking a little bit here about technology and its ability to sort of cross the divide across many different types of needs for services that most of us might have, regardless of our age. I'm wondering about the actual physical living space, and if you could talk a little bit about how to frame the conversation about the cost of making changes to your physical space to make it more aging friendly.
Sure. Look, these days, if we look at home purchases and trends in home design, young or old, what people really want is open plan types of living spaces. So that, again, when you're talking about an open plan, that's not narrow hallways, segmented rooms the way we used to have, you know, a formal living room, a formal dining room, a formal bedroom. It's open spaces where you can move around more freely. And so I think one of the things to do is look at those types of mainstream options and be able to propose them. Then things like cabinet heights or sink heights or even appliances that are smart appliances that shut on and off automatically. You know, those types of things are helpful for anyone, and they're on the marketplace, and they're new, really, really inventive things that are coming on the marketplace, too. So go and look at them. Take a look and be able to say, this is kind of interesting. And instead of just perceiving that, you know what, I can't afford to make this kind of a change, think about how you can make these incremental changes and go and shop. Make it fun. People like to shop. Go and take a look and see and have conversations with the home improvement specialist in the store. So that's one way to take a look at it. And if you have to really pound in a harsh reality with someone, take that cost and compare it to the monthly cost of being in a nursing home. That really drives home reality. So if you're talking about a $5,000 upgrade versus paying $5,000 a month in a nursing home, what's the smarter decision? Those are the types of ways that you can really, really address reality.
And that makes a lot of sense to me, too, because as we're talking with people about preparing financially for as they age, you know, again, sort of working in some of these changes, as you've mentioned, to not view it as a huge one-time event, but sort of start to make some of these changes incrementally, maybe as appliances age or certain events occur, that it's time to start making some of these changes in a small way so it doesn't feel so overwhelming and so big. I'm also wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of the desire of the baby boomers in terms of what should be around their home. You know, we've talked about the actual living space itself and they want to stay in their living space itself, but what about what's around the home? What are perceived values in terms of what surrounds their home and their community?
You know, walkability is really important. Having access to grocery stores, having access to community centers, having access to entertainment. These are all things that people want. They want to be able to get to places on their own and actually even be able to walk to them, not necessarily have to drive to them. You know, they do want a grocery store within 5 miles or less. If they can walk to a corner store even, that's terrific. They want to be able to shop. They want to be able to get access to a drugstore or the basic needs very, very readily. And when we're talking about community, I think it's also important to note when we had our last experts meeting, that was a question that came up, is what is a community? Are we talking about a city? And the response really came out that, you know what, it's really about a neighborhood. A city can be a community as well. But when we're talking about truly accessing, connecting somebody to their community, it's a neighborhood.
And I think this whole idea of nearness of goods and services is actually something that's part of a trend in community design in general right now, is to make communities more self-sustaining in terms of moving away from the suburb model more toward the integrated community model. So it seems like in many ways what the baby boomers are looking for in terms of what's nearby is sort of already part of the overall architectural trend in the U.S. right now.
That's right. And it's not something that baby boomers or even people who are 75 or 80 years old and up want. This is what young people who are in their 20s, it's what the millennials want. It's what young families want and how they are living. So it is not unique to somebody who's older. And that's the way we're going to be living, is with mixed age, mixed use, mixed types of communities, where everything is right there at our disposal, and it improves the health of everyone.
I was wondering too, we sort of talked about, you know, the brutal realities of comparing costs of upgrading your home versus the cost of nursing care. And I'm thinking about the other big sort of barrier to implementation, which is, you know, that's for old people. And I'm not an old person yet. This reminds me of my grandpa, who's 93 and refuses to do certain things because that's for old people. So I'm wondering, how do you recouch some of the need for some of these goods and services in such a way that it's not perceived as being quote unquote for old people?
You know, one of the things that I really like to talk about is if you look at health monitoring, for example, and when we're talking about chronic illness or patients or somebody with heart disease, there are these clunky monitors that they wear, or they may be embedded in their hearts or on top of them, or a big bracelet that's on somebody's wrist to monitor their health indicators. And they may be reported remotely to a doctor's office, or you may have to physically go in. But those are big visible things, too, that say, I'm sick. On the flip side, we have a lot of athletes who are wearing very, very fun, cool, high-tech types of gear, clothing, and their performance is being monitored. Well, what are those performance indicators that are being monitored? They're pure health indicators. It's their heart rate. It's their sleeping patterns. It is their movement, their speed. Why can't we utilize the same types of technologies and very, very cool attire or other types of wearables that are being used for athletes for anybody? for the same purposes as, you know, those who have chronic diseases and otherwise. That movement is actually starting to happen, and I'm so excited about that integration hopefully happening sooner rather than later. So that's one example.
So sort of making the whole concept of health monitoring kind of hip and cool rather than something that's quote-unquote just for old people.
That's right.
Are there any other examples you can think of as far as when you're thinking about someone wanting to age in place, is there anything specific that you think our listeners should be aware of or sort of in tune with in terms of themselves or their loved ones aging at home?
There are some really cutting-edge technologies that are coming into the marketplace that are not being dubbed as segmented for any part of the population specifically, that are going to have so many broad applications and uses and benefits also for people who are older. The Nest thermostat is one example. The driverless car is another example. If we think about a company like Uber that's providing transportation services, there's so many opportunities and potentials for something like that, as well as a platform for services being delivered to people. When we're talking about these drones that may be delivering packages from Amazon, when we're talking about Peapod and food delivery already taking place in a number of communities all across the country, there's things that are already in place, and they are not segmented for any particular part of the population, yet there are huge benefits for independence and people who are getting older.
It's really interesting, as you've been mentioning some of these new hip technologies, it sort of strikes me that there's a lot of crossover between what the millennials are driving for and what the baby boomers are eventually going to need in terms of their goods and services. So I think it's really interesting how those two demographics are sort of dovetailing in terms of where they're going, in terms of living space and services that they require.
That's exactly right. It is all going to be very universal, but a critical component is being able to show people how they can benefit from it, how they can use them.
I'm wondering if your think tank over there has come up with any ideas as far as sharing these ideas or demonstrating these ideas to those who are most in need of them. Has that been a part of your think tank at all so far?
Stay tuned. We've got more in the pipeline with our colleagues from Philips that we're developing. And, you know, one of the things that I think our Philips colleagues have really taken away from these sessions that we've conducted with them is that the stakeholders who are contributing towards this thinking, whether it's the local city government planning commissioners, or if it is, you know, a new entrepreneur, or if it is one of the aging organizations, or any of these different types of stakeholders, if it's a builder, for example, they want to help with the product development. They want to help and work together and collaborate to bring to market that which the consumers want. And so there's the opportunity for the consumers to really be a part of buy-in to the new products from the get-go of that point of being able to shape what those things might be and addressing the needs. So we really started this whole collaboration with Philips from the point of being able to break barriers to increase technology adoption so people can age in their homes and communities. And if we're going to truly break those barriers, then the adoption needs to happen from the inception of how do we create the right services, how do we create the right products, how do we really address the needs with the consumer involved from the very beginning.
I think this is extremely exciting, especially as we look at the rate at which baby boomers are retiring, for example, and choosing new lifestyles for themselves in retirement. So I'm really excited to see what comes out next from your collaboration with Philips. So I'll be keeping an eye out on your website for more developments.
Fantastic. I'm glad you're excited because we really are too.
Well, I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind sharing with our listeners where they might be able to go online or a number they might be able to call to get more information about the work that your group is doing in terms of this aging in place.
Absolutely. You can go to usa.philips.com/agingwellcommunities.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for taking time with us today. We really appreciate your input.
My pleasure.
Well, thanks for listening. This concludes this week's episode of Lifetime Income. And until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week. We'll be right back.
can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.